From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, adventures exploring the land that was once the largest garbage dump in America, a place that's been described as the nation's eyesore. We talk with Robert Sullivan, who's written a travel book about the swampy area of New Jersey known as the Meadowlands. Sullivan is a humorist and travel writer. Also, Darish Wishman talks about her experiences making nudist camp and sexploitation films before the X-rated era. Films like Diary of a Nudist, Bad Girls Go to Hell, and Nude on the Moon. And we'll hear from her biographer, Michael Bowen, who's helping revive her work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The two children held in the shooting spree outside an Arkansas middle school yesterday are waiting for a detention hearing in Jonesboro. The local prosecutor expects both boys will be charged with several murder counts. The 11 and the 13-year-olds allegedly tripped a school fire alarm yesterday and shot at people as they rushed out of the building. Four girls and a teacher were slain. The Supreme Court today hears arguments in two major sexual harassment cases, NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In both these cases, no one disputes that harassment took place. The question is, who's liable for damages? In one case, the city of Boca Raton, Florida, says it shouldn't have to pay damages for the harassment of its employees by their supervisors, harassment that the city's officials didn't know about. In the other case, a school board likewise claims that it's not liable for the actions of a teacher who covertly ensnared a 13-year-old student into a sexual relationship. The facts in both cases are grimy, unpleasant, and muddy, at least as to how much the people in charge wanted to know. Did they have a clearly stated sexual harassment policy? Did they deliberately turn a blind eye? Or were the victims of the harassment simply asking too much to expect protection for actions that they never complained about? Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton stopped briefly in Rwanda today. The Central African nation was torn by genocidal violence in 1994. More than 500,000 people died. NPR Charlene Hunter-Gall reports from Kigali.
President Clinton condemned the Rwandan genocide as the most intensive slaughter in this blood-filled century. He said the world didn't act soon enough to call the killings genocide, and he promised never again to be shy in the face of evidence of such crimes.
We owe to those who died and to those who survived, who love them, our every effort to increase our vigilance and strengthen our stand against those who would commit such atrocities in the future. Here or elsewhere.
The president's remarks followed a meeting with six genocide survivors who told stories of swimming in the blood of other victims, sometimes their children. He pledged $30 million to help strengthen the heavily burdened Rwandan justice system. I'm Charlene Hunter-Gall, NPR News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Meanwhile, seven African leaders have signed a commitment with Mr. Clinton to increase respect for human rights. The president says the leaders have agreed to banish genocide from Africa and bring murderers to justice. There won't be any new sanctions yet against Yugoslavia over its treatment of ethnic Albanians. The so-called contact group on Yugoslavia is meeting in Germany. The United States has failed to persuade other contact group members to support more sanctions as a way to force Yugoslavia to stop harming its Albanian citizens. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 27 points at 89.31. The Nasdaq is up 22 at 18.34. This is NPR. In NPR's business update on Wall Street, the stock market is trading at record highs. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market's advance is being led by high technology issues, which are up after Microsoft said its earnings will beat expectations thanks to strong sales of its business software. This forecast contrasts sharply with earlier profit warnings from industry leaders Intel and Compaq Computer. At the same time, semiconductor shares are advancing after Goldman Sachs added Applied Materials to its recommended list. The market's advance is being contained, though, by rising long-term interest rates, which are up on word that sales of existing homes advanced to a record rate during February. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Wall Street Journal reports that retailer Walmart is going to open new stores that are less than half the size of its trademark giant discount facilities. Stores of 40,000 square feet or less are to begin opening this fall in Arkansas, Walmart's home state. The retailer already operates more than 1,900 regular discount stores, as well as 440 large warehouse clubs known as Sam's, more than 400 of its supercenters which offer groceries and merchandise. The smaller stores will sell limited selection of what the big stores offer. Union Pacific Railroad says it won't accept new customers for its rail route through Laredo, Texas, into Mexico. The only exception is for automobiles. That's because Union Pacific needs to clear up a backlog of railroad cars that line up through Texas. The nation's biggest railroad shipper says it will stop all new shipments moving southward, except for automobiles, beginning Saturday. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's up 27 points in record territory at 8,931. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Robert Sullivan has written a book about his adventures exploring the place that was once the largest garbage dump in the world, the place he describes as the nation's eyesore. That place is the Meadowlands in New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from Manhattan's skyline. It's a 32-square-mile swamp. Because it's a problematic site to build on, it became a dumping ground for every kind of personal and industrial waste. Since 1968, the state has been trying to clean up and develop the Meadowlands. It's now the site of a large sports and entertainment complex that includes Giant Stadium, and the turnpike runs through it. But there's still plenty of swamp and plenty of garbage for Sullivan to explore. Robert Sullivan is a travel writer and humorist. His new book is called Meadowlands: Wilderness Adventures at the Edge of a City. I asked him why he wrote a travel book about the Meadowlands.
I'm one of those kind of people who is always looking out the window of the train and looking at the garbage alongside the tracks and wondering about, you know, houses that are burned down or falling down, and wondering what was in there. And this is really what the Meadowlands is, the capital of that kind of stuff. It's the land of what the heck could that be, you know. So I was living around there, and you know, I was a newspaper reporter sort of in the area. I'd get sort of tantalizingly close to the center, to the actual Meadowlands, but I'd never get into it, and I would sort of hear stories about it, what it was, but it was, you know, I never really felt like I knew the Meadowlands. Then I moved away. I moved to the West Coast. My wife's from Portland, Oregon, so I moved to Portland, Oregon. And, you know, when you move to Portland, what I did was I sort of immersed myself in the, you know, Lewis and Clark literature and the Oregon Trail literature and all these travel journals about going out to Oregon. And so when I started thinking about, you know, explorations and when I started hiking in mountains in Oregon, I thought, well, you know, everybody's going up on the Olympic Peninsula. Everybody's going to look for some place that nobody's been to. But what if you take all those, you know, your skills and your gear and you apply it to some place where, you know, nobody's ever gone? I thought, I'll go to the Meadowlands. There won't be any competition with other travel exploration explorer type people.
Sure.
And, you know, I'll just be able to, I'll go out there and I'll do a full reconnaissance. I'll really find out what's out there. And then I bought the maps and that was it. Once I got the U.S., you know, Geological Survey maps, that was it. Because they have all these symbols that I couldn't even figure out what they were until I went out to each symbol on the map to see what it was. So.
Now, since you decided to do a kind of Lewis and Clark thing through the Meadowlands, you got a canoe and actually canoed your way around the wetter parts to, like a little island in the swamp?
Well, there was one. We sort of had two goals for our two main expeditions. I hiked and canoed a lot with my friend Dave Deal. For the record, and he is the he's a relative of Meriwether Lewis, and as I say in the book, nobody's really sure what that relationship is except for his mom, so you'd have to talk to her. But anyway, we had sort of two expeditions in mind, and one was to go across the Meadowlands, which as far as we knew, nobody had ever done, and there were all these highways and water pipes, and we didn't know if we could do it. The other one was, the other goal was to go to this place on the map called Walden Swamp, which looked to be an island, or we didn't know what it was, so just wanted to get there. to Walden Swamp.
Well, I'd like you to read an excerpt from your book that gives you a, gives us a sense of what it was like when you were in your canoe, paddling around through the Meadowlands. And this is Robert Sullivan reading from his new book, Meadowlands.
Using our compass and the power lines to guide us, we canoed more, portaged again, came to a patch of land marked as water on our maps, and then crossed an abandoned railroad track, at which time it was close to noon. We were beginning to think that we had arrived on the eastern edge of the Kearney Marsh, which meant that we had another mile to go on our trip. However, our maps were proving not terribly accurate with regard to navigable water routes. Around us, there were green hills of grass-covered garbage dumps. We saw more carp, more muskrats, mud flats covered with sandpipers, and the frozen in time remains of a snapping turtle that appeared to have been decapitated by a train just as it had crawled up out of the marsh. We also saw a thermos, three unopened cans of Pepsi, a beach chair sitting on another island, and a Seven Seas red wine vinegar salad dressing spill. Passing over more underwater fences, we felt as if we were paddling just above Atlantis. At precisely 1 hour and 52 minutes into the trip, we saw our first abandoned appliance, a refrigerator. The low point of the expedition came when we found ourselves in a shallow, sewer-like creek, the bottom of which was completely covered with garbage. It was disgusting, to say the least. It was a hidden berm of trash, a refuse-strewn Sargasso Sea, and as we paddled, huge chunks of ripe debris rose up, as if from a field of underwater cabbage. A foul borscht. The smell was unbearable, and we paddled carefully.
Boy, does that sound unpleasant, but fun.
It was fun, and it was unpleasant, and shortly after, and it was nauseous, too, I think is a word that I could use. And shortly after that berm, we came to this, I don't know, this little spit of land that we were able to cross over and get back into, you know, refreshingly murky water that was just sort of normally polluted. And so that was a real relief.
Well, you write that in the Meadowlands there's many hills, and some of them are natural hills, but most of them are garbage hills. What's in the garbage hills?
Well, just about, I mean, there's only really one or two hills that aren't garbage hills, but garbage is in the garbage hills, you know, garbage that's composting, that's packing in, and you know, they have these natural streams of, I call it garbage juice, that pours out of them, but the garbage industry's term is leachate. And so there's a lot of water in the garbage hills, and the water turns into this garbage juice. And so around them you see these puddles of really gross, disgusting, warm, bluish, caramel-colored, Coca-Cola-colored stuff.
Now, is the garbage in these garbage hills legit garbage, garbage that people are legally dumping there?
There's a lot of legitimate garbage in the Meadowlands. A lot of the hills are legitimate garbage hills, I guess you'd say. But a lot of the hills, I don't know if the hills are all illegitimate garbage, but there are spots where, you know, people dumped stuff they weren't supposed to dump. In fact, I mean, people would just toss just barrels of chemicals, you know, into the Meadowlands. I mean, just anything and everything. I would often interview people about, try to find out exactly what was in a particular site or in a particular dump, and guys would say to me over and over, anything you can think of, that's what's in there.
Now, you mentioned that garbage juice called leachate. Is this the what you mean when you say that sometimes these areas have to be drained manually, almost like using a colostomy bag for the garbage hill?
Yeah, because I guess what they're trying to do to sort of solve the problem of giant garbage hills that leak garbage juice into our water stream is they build these sort of clay dikes around them, and they either put it into a pipe that'll go into a sewage system, that'll go into a sewage treatment plant, or they have to go up and manually take it out with a truck. And in the book, I talk about a sort of a problem they had at one point where the truck came up and sucked out the garbage juice. So it's a big, like, gas truck-sized truck filled with garbage juice. And I guess the guy, as it was told to me, who was driving the truck, the guy thought that he could pump the garbage juice into the city's sewer system faster, save a little time, if you just increase the pressure. And sort of worked okay, except that a lot of the people in the area of the manhole cover that he was pumping into, their toilets all sort of swelled with this leachate.
It's a wonderful story that you've brought back.
So, you might want to put a PG grossness rating on it.
What kind of wildlife did you find in your trips through the Meadowlands?
Well, we saw a lot of the standard wildlife, egrets and herons. And I'm sure it was just me, but they looked about as nervous as I was to be out there. But we also saw life that was wild. There were a lot of balloons, like party balloons out there, like Mylar balloons. And at one point, I remember we thought that maybe it was like a wild balloon sanctuary, you know, refuge. And all the birthday party balloons from Manhattan flew over to the Meadowlands and made a new life over there. But we also saw, and this would tend to be at the end of a canoe trip or an exploration, we saw sort of, you know, ducks that were modeled in a way that made me nervous that they had sort of genetically, you know, hybrided from normal ducks into Meadowlands ducks. This is on a particularly toxic creek that's known for mercury and a lot of pollutants. But then on another trip, I saw a giant muskrat slash dog slash bear. I want to say bear. And it was really scary. Although my friend Dave said it wasn't such a big deal and he would have gone on if I hadn't made him yank the canoe out of the creek.
Do you know what this animal was?
No, I don't know what that animal was. I found out that the duck was, I think it was a Muscovy duck, and it was from South America. And a family there, a Muslim family, was raising them, I think for food. And then I never found out what the giant muskrat slash bear slash dog slash anything else was, but it was probably giant muskrat. But the side of the creek said danger. It said danger, caution. There were signs all along the creek. And when I saw that animal with those signs, I got a little panicked. And Dave wants to go back and try to finish that part of the trip. But my wife says if I do, then we can't have any more children.
Oh, was she, 'cause she's afraid of...
Concerned for, you know, how it'll affect my
genetics.
Physiology.
Yeah. My guest is Robert Sullivan, author of the new book, The Meadowlands. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Sullivan, author of The Meadowlands, Wilderness Adventures at the Edge of a City. Now, there's a lot of mythology surrounding the Meadowlands, and perhaps the most famous part of the mythology is that Jimmy Hoffa is reputed to be buried there.
Yes, reputed is one of the reasons you want to write anything at all about the mob, because you get to say and type the word reputed. And that was when I first started doing this, I would say, I'm going to write a book about the Meadowlands. I'm doing a project on the Meadowlands. And people would say either, you mean the Meadowlands where the Giants play? What's the book, you know? And I say, no, I'm not going to do it with the Giants. I'm going to do everything else but the Meadowlands Arena. But the other thing that they'd say is, you mean where they buried Jimmy Hoffa? And I'd say, yeah, that's right. And at first I was a little annoyed at that because there's a lot more to the Meadowlands than the myth of Jimmy Hoffa. But then it became clear that I would have to address the reputed burial of Jimmy Hoffa in the Meadowlands. And after a while, we started thinking we ought to see where he was buried. And then, we thought we might as well give it a shot, try to dig there. I didn't know what we would do if we found Jimmy Hoffa. That would sort of be a problem, I suppose.
Where did you decide to dig for Jimmy Hoffa in the Meadowlands?
There were a couple of sites we looked at for digging for Jimmy Hoffa in the Meadowlands. And one of them was the Giants' end zone, of course, because everybody says, he's buried in the Giants' end zone. I guess that's because some of the people associated with people who were associated with the building of the Meadowlands, the word reputed was hanging around them. And so people thought, oh, well, maybe the mob somehow got it into the construction site. But I tackled that. First of all, that was difficult. It would have been difficult to get permission to dig in the end zone. But I felt that that was covered because I met a guy who videotaped. He was like an early videotaper. And he videotaped the construction of Giant Stadium, like frame by frame. So I always thought that I could just go to him and get the tape and review it if need be. But we settled on a site called the PJP Landfill, Brother Moscato's Dump. And it's this dump that's sort of its, you know, AKA. It's this dump that's underneath the Pulaski Skyway, which is this beautiful old bridge, black snake-like bridge that goes across the Meadowlands. And that dump, the FBI, like, watched that dump. The state police guarded that dump when they were looking for Jimmy Hoffa. And everybody seemed to think, it was my reading of the papers, that he was in that dump, or at least some of his associates were. And but in the end, they never did dig in it. And I guess one of the reasons was they feared for the safety of the state police. It was like the FBI said, oh, you dig for it. And then the state police was like, oh, no, you dig for it. Or at least that's how I read it. So we decided on Brother Moscato's dump. And, you know, we got some shovels and first we had to find it. It was so hard to get in it through fences and highways. But then when we got there, it was surrounded by a moat of garbage juice, kind of leachate moat. And it looked really difficult. And so I went through the state and I signed permits and releases. And they gave me a tour of the site, which I sort of just sat there and tried to channel and see if he was there, in fact. And it felt good. It felt likely.
There are a lot of myths about things that are buried in the Meadowlands, including Jimmy Hoffa. But you found out from actually a newspaper article that the columns from the old Penn Station in Manhattan were buried in the Meadowlands, and you figured you should go try to unearth them. How did you do?
Well, Penn Station was digging for Penn Station, or finding Penn Station, was like a consolation prize for us. If you can't get Jimmy Hoffa, maybe you can get Penn Station. And so I went with pictures from the 60s of the old Penn Station being dumped in the Meadowlands, and I went around all the towns. And a lot of people didn't believe me at first, or they thought maybe I'd made up the photo. But after a while, I found a couple of people, the retired mayor of Secaucus and various dump owners who helped me, and we sort of pinpointed a site and triangulated with the old photos and just dug.
What'd you find?
Well, we found tons of stuff. You dig in the Meadowlands, and you just pull up stuff. You pull up like huge wires and cables and glass, and I've got a creamer at home that we use. It must be for an old hotel in New York, because they would take all the hotel garbage in from the Plaza Hotel into the Meadowlands and dump in the Meadowlands. But we found pieces of buildings that had dates that were sort of similar to the dates of Penn Station, but we didn't really know. And you know, when you're digging in the Meadowlands, if you ever are digging in the Meadowlands for Penn Station, you will find that everything starts to look like Penn Station, and everything becomes, you know, possibly Penn Station. But after a while, I was just walking down the street or driving around, and I ran into a guy who said, oh, yeah, I remember where they buried Penn Station. It's over there in that lot. And so I just kind of went back into this lot in this trucking yard, and there were huge pieces of the columns, you know, these Roman replicas just lying there and you know, sort of partly buried, but I chipped off a piece of it, brought it home.
God, it's like finding gold.
It was really like finding gold. And I stare at the rock all the time. I have it here with me today. I stare at the rock all the time and look at it and think about Penn Station and about the moment in the future, many, you know, hundreds of years from now, when someone will be digging in the Meadowlands, hopefully an archaeologist, and they'll come upon this huge train station. They'll say, this was the center of a great civilization. This was the great center of a city. And then somebody will say, oh, no, it was a dump. And they'll say, oh, yeah, you're right.
So show me what you brought here.
I got the piece of Penn Station here. There it is. It's a piece of Penn Station.
Okay, what I'm looking at is, it looks to me like a piece of rock.
It's oh, it's not just rock. It's Penn Station. It's the bottom. And it takes a long time to chip off these, you know, marble columns.
So this is a big chip from one of the marble columns.
It's a big chip. I had more, but I sent it out to friends.
Well, I'm glad for the chance to have seen it. It's mighty impressive. The Meadowlands now is something between the marshland that it was naturally and the garbage dump that it became. And now the state is trying to clean it up and to figure out a plan for it. So what do we have now? It's like neither one nor the other.
Right. And that's what's most intriguing for me about the Meadowlands, is that it's this third party. It's like a dialectic that's happened, and there's this new synthesis, this new kind of land. And so you see like a fallen down factory with reeds all around it and in it, and you say, what is that? Is that beautiful? And I think it is beautiful. But do you save a fallen down factory? I don't know, but it's to me, it's really beautiful.
So it raises a lot of new interesting questions for you.
It raises interesting questions, and you know, and here's an area where people definitely ruined it. And so one of the big controversies in the Meadowlands is, how far do we go to fix it? How much work do we put into fixing it, or do we just let it be?
Is the ruin itself interesting enough,
yeah,
to save as a kind of relic of an era?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
way we ruined a certain kind of land in a certain era.
Yeah, well, there's one part of the Meadowlands that's there's very little reed and swamp left at all, and it's kind of a spit down in the bottom right near Newark Bay, and that's there's a lot of old factories that are falling down there. I'm sure they're remediation sites, you know, for hazardous waste, but it's not quite haunted when you drive around there. But it's like an old Western mining town that'd be preserved, except that it's factories in New Jersey.
Is there like a favorite image that you've taken away with you from the Meadowlands?
Well,
just like a mind picture that just kind of sums it up for you.
I guess crawling out or canoeing out or hiking out to one of these sites, like a fallen radio tower, or going out to the radio towers, and then. Realizing you're surrounded by reeds, and it seems so quiet, and but then you look up and all of a sudden you're being attacked by a huge FedEx plane landing at Newark Airport. So that's the kind of thing that I remember about the Meadowlands.
Robert Sullivan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Sullivan's new book is called The Meadowlands: Wilderness Adventures at the Edge of a City. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Behind the Nudist Curtain, filmmaker Doris Wishman talks about how she became a pioneer in sexploitation films. And we'll hear from her biographer, Michael Bowen.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the days before you could show nudity on screen, a legal loophole allowed you to show nude people at nudist camps. Doris Wishman is one of the filmmakers who took advantage of that by making nudist camp films like Diary of a Nudist, Nude on the Moon, Blaze Star Goes Nudist, Behind the Nudist Curtain, and The Prince and the Nature Girl. To justify the nudity, the films extolled the healthy lifestyle of nudist camps.
As you know, I moved to Miami from Kansas City only a few months ago.
I see.
I've been a nudist for many years now. I really believe it has made a better and more tolerant person out of me. Certainly a healthier and happier one.
I know what you mean. I've never felt as healthy and as alive as I do since I've joined this lodge. I wish I could make other people understand how beneficial, both mentally and physically, it is to be a nudist.
Doris Wishman followed up her nudist films with sexploitation films like Bad Girls Go to Hell, Another Day, Another Man, A Taste of Flesh, and Too Much, Too Often. She was perhaps the only woman making independently produced sexploitation films in the 60s and 70s. Now her work is being shown at repertory cinemas and film festivals. My guest Michael Bowen is writing a biography of her and trying to revive her work. We'll meet Doris Wishman a little later. I asked Michael Bowen to describe nudie cuties, or the nudist camp film genre.
Technically, there's a distinction between the nudie cutie and the nudist camp film. Russ Meyer is best known for having invented the nudie cutie in 1959 with a film called The Immoral Mr. Tease, and that's really sort of a celluloid version of a Playboy magazine. And the nudie cutie, I would argue, is largely a West Coast phenomenon due to difference in censorship laws and structures. On the East Coast, however, in the mid-50s, a small-time independent producer named Walter Bebo made a film called Garden of Eden, and it was a melodrama essentially cast in a nudist camp. He was able to produce this film with an expectation of getting it exhibited because high courts had ruled that nudism and nudist magazines, magazines espousing the nudist lifestyle, which was sort of a phenomenon of the time, couldn't be discriminated against, that nudism was a valid social philosophy and therefore was not obscene. So Bebo made this picture, and he took it around the country in small venues and did okay, but when he tried to get into big East Coast cities like New York and Boston, he was shut down almost immediately by the then existing censor boards. He won a number of court battles, and by the late 50s, the film was playing all over the place. Doris had worked for a distribution entity that was involved with the distribution of the film in a small part of the country, as I understand it. And after she got out of distribution, she got it into her head that she would go into production and make a nudist film, which she knew had been financially successful. That's the version of the story she tells. I suppose we could speculate as to why it is that she was attracted to the genre herself personally, but she says she figured that it would do well commercially.
What were you allowed to show? You were allowed to show breasts and buttocks. Was that it?
You were allowed to show breasts. You were allowed to show bottoms. Oftentimes, you probably appreciate that it's difficult to construct a shot in such a way that it covers other private areas effectively. So Doris and other filmmakers would do things like have people walk around with a large hat or a towel or a beach ball or something held down low in front of their genital area so that it wouldn't be exposed. I know also Doris oftentimes, when she showed a volleyball game, would mysteriously have the side that was necessarily facing the camera wear shorts. These were the sort of manipulations that were necessary to produce at the time. I find now that when you see some of these films, and some of them are available on video, it's an element of their charm, because it's very obvious that the producer-director had to go out of their way to orchestrate these situations so that they could show something, but not too much.
So there's no sex in these films?
No, there's no sex at all in these films, it's probably a crucial a part of their legitimacy. The films are not about sex. And from my own research into this area, and there hasn't been a lot of intelligent scholarly work written on the nudist movement, certainly there's room to write more, But from the things I've been able to find, that's fairly consistent with the practices of nudists at the time and the nudist philosophy. Exhibition of sexual arousal was considered sort of the cardinal sin of nudism. Within the context of the nudist camp, people were not supposed to become sexually aroused, and they weren't there to be sexually aroused. They were there to sort of get back in touch with their bodies as a natural entity that wasn't, perhaps ironically in some ways, wasn't about sex. In some ways, the movement itself had fairly conservative social values, given the kind of nascent sexual revolution that I would argue was already gaining momentum by that time. Certainly, we're in a kind of like post Playboy magazine phase, and the swinger and the bachelor and the ladies' man are becoming sort of very prevalent cultural figures at this time. So nudism, and in some ways Doris's films along with nudism, was a relatively sexually conservative ideology.
Doris Wishman went from making nudist camp films to making sex exploitation films later in the 60s. And some of the films she made were about rough sex, about rape and whippings, and not very graphic, because there was a limit, I suppose, to what you could show.
That's right.
But why did she change to in this kind of sex exploitation direction?
Well, as Doris has explained it to me, she changed in that direction because everybody did. The nudist camp film had kind of played out by, say, 63, 64. It became clear that producers weren't able to contrive new and interesting plots. The audiences were starting to dwindle. People who were going to see these films had basically seen enough. That seems fairly clear. Doris would tell you, as she's told me, I assume, that she just followed the trend and got out of the nudist camp genre, which she was not only a pioneer in, but as far as I know, is probably the most prolific single producer director in that genre. She produced 8 films. She told me one time she would have continued to make them forever if they had stayed popular, because she felt that she could contrive new storylines, but people weren't going to them anymore. So starting around 64, I think, would probably be the best date. A new sort of exploitable picture that began quickly to incorporate a limited amount of nudity, but was really more about sexual situations, began to hit the exploitation circuit, or the grindhouse circuit, as it's sometimes called.
Doris Wishman is a woman making these sex exploitation movies. Do you think you can see that in the point of view of the films?
I would argue that you could. I think that if you look at the films made by these other producer directors that I've mentioned, and then look at Doris's films, you'll see that there are definite differences. Women characters, until very late in Doris's work in this genre, are always central to the films. They're generally women who find themselves in difficult situations. They're seeking economic or sexual autonomy and are generally unable to find it. It's a kind of very grim commentary on a world before feminism, so to speak, a world in which feminism doesn't sort of sit on the horizon. There's not a lot of hope in Doris's films. While the plots are usually constructed as melodramas, which generally have a happy ending, Doris's films almost always suddenly twist tragically in the very last minute. So while she works with many of the tropes of the genre, she obviously knew what other director-producers around Ninth Avenue in New York, where these films were made, were doing at the time. She really subverts the genre, I would argue, and I think has interesting implications when you think about the fact that she was the only woman working in this genre.
Well, Michael Bowen, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Doris's work.
Michael Bowen is writing a biography of Doris Wishman. His working title is Queen of Sexploitation. We'll meet Wishman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Doris Wishman started making nudist camp movies in 1960, then moved on to sexploitation films. She was recently the guest of honor at the New York Underground Film Festival. Her 1965 film, Bad Girls Go to Hell, is playing at several repertory theaters. I asked her why she started making nudist camp movies.
My husband died, and I wanted to do something that would take my mind off the tragedy. He was very young, I was very young. And I was also a frustrated actress. I had gone to drama school with Shelley Winters and always felt that I was far better than she, but she pursued her career, and I just went on to other things. In any event, I wanted to do something that would just keep me so occupied that I couldn't think of what had occurred. Anyway, Garden of Eden, which was the very first nudist picture ever filmed, had been quite successful, and so I decided to make a nudist film.
When you were making nudist camp movies, what were the rules of the game? What were you allowed to show? What couldn't you show?
Well, you couldn't show any frontal shots. That was all. Other than that, you could show any other part of the body.
You could show the naked breast.
You could show the breast. You could show everything but the frontal part, the penis and the vagina, you know. But in the nudist camp, of course, that was allowed. As a matter of fact, when I went to shoot my nudist film, the owner of the camp said, you know, you have to be in the nude in order to work here. First of all, she read the script and approved of it. And she said, you have to be in the nude. And this was in Miami, of course. And I said, no, forget it. When my cameraman called from New York, I felt that he would say the same as I, forget it. When I said, Ray, you know, in order to shoot, you've got to be in the nude. He said, great. But, of course, he wasn't because he had to have, you know, wear pants so that he could have things in his pockets. Anyway, I told Zelda Sapley, who owned the camp, that I wouldn't do it. And she said, well, you know what, can you just wear shorts and a top? And I said, well, naturally, what else would I wear? I'd wear that in any event, you know. And so that we were allowed to shoot there.
What was it uncomfortable for you as a woman to be making
nudist
movies, and there were virtually no other women
doing this. But you know what it is, Terry? At first, when I went to the nudist camp, I was very embarrassed. So embarrassed. I couldn't. And you know what? After 2 or 3 days, suddenly it was normal. I was no longer embarrassed. And don't forget, there was no sex in these films, just nudity.
Were there certain things that were kind of obligatory to show in the nudist camp movies, you know, like sports, volleyball? You have some archery scenes.
No, but the point is, this is what happened. This is a form of their socializing. This was what they did. They played volleyball, they played handball or whatever. I showed what was really happening. Swimming, you know, in the pool and so on. I just filmed as they played, and then I paid them, you know, unless most of them were just nudist campers. And they were paid, and that was it.
I think a particularly amusing shot from one of your movies, one of the nudist camp movies, there's a naked accordionist sitting down, and the accordion, of course, obscures his privates. And he's serenading a group of nudists who are sitting in a circle, holding hands and swaying to the, I have to say, very square rhythm of his accordion. It's actually a very amusing scene in a way. Tell me about that scene.
I just filmed what was happening. This was really happening. These were not actors. The fellow that was playing the accordion worked for Zelda. I think they might have been partners. I'm not sure. It was just a scene. I mean, it was just another scene that I shot when I saw what they were doing. I said, I'm going to shoot anybody that doesn't want to be in it. Please leave. Nobody left. So I got releases, paid them.
Why did you stop making nudist camp movies?
Because after I started making nudist films, about 10 other distributors or producers, whatever, started making nudist films, and suddenly they were no longer interesting or exciting. And besides, I wanted to go on to bigger and better things.
So what did you go on to?
I went on to making black and white, of course. Regular feature films. No longer nudist films. My first film was Sex Perils of Paulette, which was a... And incidentally, Tony LeBianco, you've heard of him.
Mm-hmm, the actor?
He was in the first film, Sex Perils of Paulette.
What did he play?
One of the lovers that she had. One of her boyfriends.
What was the plot?
Oh, God, you don't want to hear the plot. It was just a plot.
I want to hear the plot.
Do you insist?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think I can? If I can remember 30 years back, about a girl that comes to town from a little from a hick town and her adventures in the city and the people she meets and so on. Very ordinary. It was good, but wasn't great. But I did what I could, you know, my best. And then after that, I made Too Much Too Often, Taste of Flesh, Indecent Desires, My Brother's Wife, Another Day, Another Man.
Well, how'd you come up with the titles?
I don't know. You know what? At night when you go to bed, I would think of millions of things, and if I was lucky, I'd remember them in the morning. You know, you just think of titles.
The Too Much Too Often is very suggestive. What's it really about?
Oh, Terry, you don't want to know. It's just a film. I mean, no. Look, I want to tell you something. Yeah. I never made Hardcore because I was scared.
Scared of what?
Of getting in trouble. You know, I don't disapprove of it because nobody's twisting your arm. If you want to see Hardcore, that's your privilege. But I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. Some of my friends who made Hardcore riding around limos, and I have to take taxis or a bus. But the fellow that made Deep Throat was a friend of mine. He called me one day and he said he was making Deep Throat, a picture called Deep Throat. And I said, "You're crazy, Jerry. What kind of title is that?" And then he told me what it was about. And I said, "Oh, my God, you are mad." But you know what? He wasn't mad. He knew what he was doing, but I couldn't do it. First, as a female, I couldn't do it. Second,
wait, let me stop you there. Why couldn't you do it as a female?
I can't explain it. It went against me. As I said, I don't disapprove. It's none of my business. But I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't do it, period.
Did you feel like you would have been exploiting the women in the movies?
Oh, no. If you, look, first of all, you have their consent. Secondly, you pay them. Then nobody's twisting their arm. You know that girls kept coming to me, men kept coming to me, asking if they could be in my films. And some of them I was able to work with, and some I couldn't, didn't need. How can they be exploited if they're paid properly?
As a woman, did you feel uncomfortable depicting the kind of sex, depicting sex the way it's often depicted in pornography, which is often with a kind of brutal edge to it?
But I never did that. Mm-hmm. I never did that. Mm-hmm. So
okay.
I couldn't.
You said you had two reasons. What was the second?
Why I couldn't do it?
Yeah.
First of all, I found it very hard to even shoot normal sex scenes. And I'm not talking about Hardcore. And secondly, I disapproved of it. But that doesn't mean that it should be a ban against it. That's just me. I don't like Hardcore. I think sex is a... should even normal sex should be a private thing. So how could I shoot Hardcore?
No, although you didn't shoot Hardcore, there was, you know, a lot of sexuality in the films. For instance, in Bad Girls Go to Hell, that film is about a married woman who was raped by the janitor or superintendent, and he forces her to come back to his room where she's raped again, and he threatens to
tell
her.
No, but he doesn't rape her twice.
Well, no, actually, she kills him.
Yeah, that's right.
She tries to just, like, knock him out the second time and accidentally kills him. And then she feels like she can't go back to her husband. She has to flee town. And as she goes to the big city, she keeps meeting person after person who kind of involves her in sexual escapade after sexual escapade. You know, some of them...
But you never see anything happening. You don't see any sex scenes.
No, you see everything implied, but you don't see anything after.
Well, that's the point,
right? But it's still playing. Anyways,
it's still
films that revolve around sex.
You know, well, naturally,
yeah.
You know that ashtray that she hits him with,
uh-huh.
kills him with. That has committed so many murders. I bought that in California about 20. About on my word of honor, it's. I bought that in California about 30 years ago. Because I liked it. You know, it was attractive.
Uh-huh.
And I've used it as a weapon in so many films. It's really funny.
Is that like a common theme of yours? Is it cheaper to knock somebody out with an ashtray in one of your movies?
No. It just happened. It wasn't deliberate. You know, Terry, it wasn't deliberate. It just happened that way. Uh-huh. The ashtray was next to her. This was not deliberate. Many of the things that were done that people acclaim just happened because I had no choice. They weren't deliberate.
Did you ever think that you brought a different point of view to your movies because you were a woman?
Possibly, but I didn't think that way when I made the film. As I said before, all I thought about was making a film that was as good as and exciting and interesting and, of course, commercial as I could. I never thought about the fact that being a woman, my film might be different from the man next door who made a film. It didn't occur to me.
My guest is Doris Wishman. We'll talk more about her films after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Doris Wishman, she started her career making nudist camp films in the 1960s, then made sexploitation films in the 60s and 70s. Her work is being revived in repertory cinemas and film festivals. What made you want to direct movies in the first place? I know first you wanted to act in them, but you turned to direction. But you did this in the very early 1960s when, I mean, there virtually were no women film directors, you know, in any part of the industry. I mean, there were some, there were like Ida Lupino, for instance, yeah. But there were really
I don't think she was directing
then. So what you know, what made you think of directing?
Well, I knew I wasn't going to be an actress anymore, you know, and I wanted to do something that was really a challenge, and this was a challenge. Now, the point is, I just wanted to get involved, so that's what I did. And I will say that when I started, my sister gave me $10,000, which was a great deal of money at that time. And when I shot, it was stuff that had to be thrown away. But it was healthy for me because when I went to bed at night, instead of dreaming about my dead husband, I would say, if I give my sister back $10 a week for the rest of my life, I'll return the 10. You know, but it was healthy thinking, Terry. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah, right.
So then I finally had to tell my sister, I said, Pearl, I just... So she gave me another $10,000. And this time I really, really, really went to town. And then I took the film to New York because certainly didn't shoot the film, you know, make the film for $10,000. And this company that bought the film financed me. And that's how I got started. But the first time I shot, I couldn't use the footage.
Did you ever try to parlay your films into a more mainstream career? Or into a Hollywood career?
No, but, you know, I'll tell you this. I could have gone to Hollywood. Paramount asked me to go to work for them. UA asked me to go to work for them. And you know what? I said, oh, no, I'm not working for anybody. Oh, I could. When I think of it, I could just kick myself. I had opportunities to go to Hollywood. I just didn't want to take them because I'm not too bright, I guess.
Well, you thought you'd...
I felt I wanted to be on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing well. I loved what I was doing. I had nobody to tell me what to do and how to do. And it was, of course, it was a mistake. But then, you know, it's hindsight. What am I going to do?
Now, you were able to make your movies at very low budgets. What are some of the tricks to keeping movies cheap?
Tricks. Well, you see, as a matter of fact, I had no tricks. That's why my movies were more costly than they should have been. I really had no tricks. Everything I did was of the best. So I really didn't cut corners, but I should have.
One of the things that you did was you added the sound after the movie was shot. So instead of recording the dialogue as it was spoken, it was dubbed in afterwards.
All right, now let me tell you why. Firstly, most of the people that I worked with, like Chesty Morgan, couldn't speak well. Chesty had an accent, a Polish accent. She was from Poland. Some of the others I was able to use sound, you know, direct sound, but most of these actors and actresses, they just didn't speak well, whereas if when I dubbed it, which was more another thing, dubbing is much more costly, you know. It's very costly. But at least they sounded as though they could speak. Now, that, too, was a mistake. I didn't try to cut corners, Terry, and that was ridiculous, now that I look back.
Now, you mentioned Chesty Morgan. She was kind of infamous in her time, nicknamed Chesty because she had an exceptionally large chest.
Yes. That was the gimmick. In one film, she's a spy, and she has a camera implanted in one of her breasts so that when she has to take a picture of documents or people, you know, involved, she has to expose her breast and snap, you know, bing, snap the picture. That's as far as there was no sex in it.
But you got to see her a lot because she had to take lots of pictures, probably, right?
Not too many. Terry, not too many. Because then it's not exciting if you overdo it, Terry. Well,
how did Chesty Morgan react to that?
Well, fine. Anything she could do to make money, she didn't care. She would have done anything.
You're hoping to make movies again.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You haven't made one since your footage for A Night to Dismember was destroyed in the lab a few years ago, and you lost a lot of money when that happened. Right. What kind of movies are you hoping to make now?
Well, feature films, but of a better caliber. And I really shouldn't use that term because I consider the films that I did make very, very good. It's called Each Time I Kill. And it's while it's a horror film, it's just done so, it's different and it's great, and horror films are in now. It isn't a horror film, and I don't even know how to describe it. And then I've got a script called Tapestry of Terror, another script called Hell Hath No Fury, and I'm working on a sitcom, which I want to do, called Jane Blonde. It's great, really great.
I wish you good luck with those.
Well, the thing is, I never had investors, so it's very difficult for me to ask for money. I always felt I had to do everything.
Right.
And that's
a mistake.
It doesn't
work anymore, yeah.
No, it never did work.
Yeah.
I wrote the script. I directed. I cast. I took care of the makeup. I did the editing. I chose the music. That's not the way to work. You have to be able to relegate various jobs to other people, and I never was able to do that. I always felt I was the only one that could do it, and that is so ridiculous.
Well, Doris Wishman, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
You're more than welcome.
Doris Wishman's 1965 movie Bad Girls Go to Hell is showing at several Repertory cinemas around the country. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, some advice about caring for seriously ill loved ones. We talk with Roger McFarlane, former director of Gay Men's Health Crisis and author of The Complete Bedside Companion. Also, we meet Ellen's real-life mom, Betty DeGeneres. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.